This is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. On the show this week, we'll travel to an island in Indonesia that is home to one of the most dangerous creatures in the world. It's also named after it. And you can also hear why soon you might be able to drive an actual tree. Something like that. The details are a little bit different. They're a little bit sketchy, but we'll talk about it in just a sec. And I've got your questions to answer in just a sec. And one of them is ridiculously smart. It's one of those things that is so easy, you can understand why they've sent in the question, but we've never really thought about it. You can hear the answer in just a sec. First, let's see how the internet is talking to everything around us all the time to make our lives even easier. This is Techno Mum's Connected World.
Techno Mum's Connected World.
So, we're on the motorway on the long drive to Nan's house. It always takes forever. How much longer, Mum?
Another hour at least. I can't wait till you're old enough to do some of the driving. I'm shattered. Why don't you have a snooze?
Hey, just think, by the time I can drive, maybe we'll have a driverless car. Then we can both have a nap. So why haven't we seen them on the roads yet? I know they've been doing loads of trials.
It's not just the technology inside the cars that has to evolve. It's the technology of, well, everything.
What do you mean?
Well, driverless cars need to gather information about what's going on around them. They'll need to communicate with other cars.
So they could tell if another car is indicating or changing direction, so they don't cause a crash.
And about the road conditions. Accessing traffic information. Talking of which...
Congestion ahead. Expected delay is 25.
Oh, no.
Rerouting.
Don't panic. Look, the sat-nav is finding us a shortcut.
So, we're already using connected tech?
Yep, some of that technology is already in use. Driverless cars will be constantly updated about the roads, and even what's around the roads.
Like what?
People? Pedestrians? Imagine if someone ran out in front of the car.
I guess cars will have sensors on, and know when to hit the brakes.
Absolutely. But think about this. What if two people ran out and the car could swerve but would still hit one person? How would a smart car decide who to hit?
It couldn't. Could it?
Lots of us have smartphones with GPS, which helps us find where we are on the map. Cars could access this information to find the personal details of the pedestrians. Maybe one's a banker and the other's a surgeon. The car might decide the surgeon deserved to live.
So you'd have the car, a machine, deciding whose life was worth more? Not sure I'd like that.
It's just a thought experiment, but it shows you some of the challenges car designers are facing. We need as much information as we can to make the best decisions, but some decisions aren't as simple as turning left or right.
It's still really cool to think about what we'd be like in the future.
Oh, and the future isn't that far away. There are already apps that can tell you the health of your car, like how fuel efficient you've driven, and if there are any faults.
Does it also record if you're idling when in stationary traffic, or have switched off the engine?
There's so many useful things we'll be able to do with connected cars. Just imagine. If you needed a car parking space, the car could go online, find out where the nearest one was, and even reserve you a space.
And maybe it could put your order in at the restaurant in the perfect amount of time before you arrive.
Just think, our car could communicate with Gran and get her to put the kettle on.
Techno Mum's Connected World, with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology. Find out more at fungoodslive.com/technomum.
I got a few of the questions that you've sent over to the review page over on Apple Podcasts for the Science Weekly to answer now. Remember last week we did a space special to celebrate 50 years since Apollo 11 landed on the moon? Well, Mia has sent in loads of questions all about space. I'm going to rattle through just a few of them for you, Mia. One of them is, why is it dark in space? Well, there's a few answers to this. First, we have to think about why our sky is bright blue. It's because the light from the sun hits loads of molecules that are flying through our atmosphere, and the light kind of reflects and refracts off them and makes a blue colour. And because there's little atmosphere in space, there's nothing to really reflect the light up there into different colours, so it appears black. Also, because space is so, so big, the light sources that there are there that give out light, it tends to drift away pretty quickly. And also Mia's asked about a light year, what it is. A light year is used to measure distance in space. It's the distance that light travels in a year. Now, light travels at 186,000 miles a second. And let's do the maths. There are 31,536,000 seconds in a year. So that means that in a year, light travels 6 trillion miles. That's what a light year is. Thanks for those, Mia. Also, this is a big one, so strap yourselves in. It's from Ellie in Australia. She asks, if apes evolved into humans, why are there still apes? It's such an amazingly obvious, brilliant question, isn't it? And it's because you're kind of missing one of the fundamental things about evolution, Ellie. And it's that when one thing is evolved from another, the other thing doesn't die off. It doesn't necessarily die. It's not necessarily killed, sorry. Because it's quite an easy answer. We didn't just evolve from apes. Both apes and humans evolved from a common ancestor. And evolution is happening all the time, pretty much, with all living things. DNA changes, then that DNA is passed to other generations, and then the fittest survive. Now, millions of years ago, scientists think, back in Africa, the ape-like ancestors that we both share, they lived there. And it was full of forest, and it was really wet. But then over time, the ecology, the environment changed, so the apes had to do different things. Some stayed in the forest, some went off into the grasslands, and because those environments are completely different, we kind of changed and evolved into different creatures. So that's why, years later, the two groups have eventually become humans and apes. There you go. I did say strap yourselves in. It was quite a long, complex one, but such a brilliant question. Thanks for that, Ellie. If you've got something sciencey that you want answered on this show, you need to leave it as a review on Apple Podcasts for the Fun Kids Science Weekly. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, Earth's Dinosaur Zoo is coming to the Edinburgh Fringe this summer, all the way from Australia, where you can get, like, properly hands-on with some ancient beasts. It's kind of like a dinosaur petting zoo, and the host and director of the show, Scott Wright, he can tell us loads more. He's on the line from Down Under. Hey, Scott.
G'day.
Hey, nice. Thank you so much for joining us, because you're a whole world away, so I really appreciate it. With Dinosaur Zoo, I've seen clips from it online as it's this dinosaur petting zoo. What was the first kind of idea you had for bringing these creatures to life?
It started quite a few years ago in Melbourne, where we were invited by the Melbourne or the Victorian Museum to make some life-size or to scale dinosaur puppets for them. And they were such a hit that we ended up kind of getting commissioned by a number of museums all over the world. And then we realized how well those museums were doing with our puppets and decided we should make some for ourselves. And as a kind of a tongue-in-cheek, we decided we'd make a dinosaur petting zoo, because there's nothing like Australians putting children in dangerous situations. and the show kind of evolved out of that. And now it's literally all over the world.
Now, what we know about dinosaurs, we take from fossils. So we don't really have a great artistic understanding of what they really look like. How have you worked on that to bring these creatures to life?
I mean, we get to meet and work with some really great paleontologists. Because of the connection to museums, then we've really endeavoured to create dinosaurs based on the information that those paleontologists were able to give us. And one of the paleontologists that would have to be one of my favourite is a gentleman by the name of Louis Chiappe, who heads up the Dinosaur Institute in Los Angeles. And one of the things that he said to me that always resonates is the imagination is the most important tool, or is a very important tool when it comes to paleontology, because, yes, we only have their fossils, and no one was around 66 or 120 million years ago, so no one could take any photos, no one could take any video, and so paleontologists have to use a lot of hypotheses, which, you know, is a kind of fancy way, I guess, of saying using their imagination to take all the knowledge that they have and try to piece together what they think a dinosaur may have looked like, or how a dinosaur may have behaved, or the environmental circumstances in which they lived. And I think that's a really great lesson to kids as well, because kids have fantastic imaginations. And to know that your imagination can be a tool is, you know, it's ace.
Talk to us more about, you mentioned how they behaved. If you've made these puppets and then on stage you're bringing them to life, how do you know how they would act, how they would behave, how they would walk, what they would do if they were approaching a real life human being? How do you know that, Scott? And then how do you bring it to life? What are your favourite ones that are up there?
So I reckon, again, it all comes back to that imagination being a tool. The things that we can determine about how a dinosaur may have moved is by looking at their anatomy and then measuring that against another creature that may have a similar anatomy. So when you look at theropods, you know, you can also look at birds. We now know a very strong hypothesis that some dinosaurs didn't go extinct and evolved into birds. So we do look at birds as a source of inspiration for when we're trying to work out how they might have walked or how they might have behaved. But then we also have understandings that, you know, certain dinosaurs may have lived in packs or large groups because a large amount of fossils of the same dinosaur are found in the same location. So at the moment, one of the inspirations that I'm drawing from are wolves, because wolves are pack animals. They hunt in groups, but they also have a unique kind of level of communication. And I've been applying this to what is currently my favourite dinosaur, which is the Fukui raptor, which is a Japanese dinosaur. And, you know, taking a bit of artistic licence, we've gone into the old Shinto stories of Okami, or Japanese wolves, and how they behaved, you know, in sort of very old sort of animist stories. So, yeah, there are things that we can hypothesize, or that we can have a fairly good idea of what we think, but then I think that's when the artist within me sort of also gets to take a bit of license and go, how do I get a puppeteer to understand that I want them to do is to be light on their feet, and I want them to be interested in their environment, so therefore I ask them to smell their environment rather than look at their environment. And, you know, there's lots and lots and lots of different things that I ask of the puppeteers in order to try and give them a very clear sort of animal behaviour.
Can you give us any examples of dinosaurs that you, as a group, act as throughout the show that maybe behave in a way unexpected from what we would imagine them to do?
So there's one of the dinosaurs in our show are the Lialanosaura. They're a small ornithopod that was found in a place called Dinosaur Cove, which is sort of the southeastern part of Australia. And what we know about them is that they lived at a time when Australia was much closer to the South Pole. So based on that, and based on their eye sockets, there is a hypothesis that they had the largest eyes to scale of any dinosaur that's been found. So that would have meant that they, because of their location, they would have lived in semi-darkness for periods of time. So they were able to see in the dark. And, you know, I, as far as behaviour, you know, I think that that's quite a unique one. There are only certain animals in the world that we live in now that do see in the dark. So to think that there were dinosaurs that were kind of getting around being able to see, I guess not infrared, but, you know, being able to see in the dark is a quite a unique talent or skill or behaviour.
Amazing. Scott, thank you so much for joining us. So Earth's Dinosaur Zoo is playing throughout August up at the Underbelly, the Bristow Place in Edinburgh at the Fringe Festival. Really good luck with it. Thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly to tell us more.
Thanks. Have a good whatever you have.
Now, for this week's Dangerous Dan, we're travelling to an island in Indonesia. And whilst the island isn't absolutely deadly itself, it is home to one of the most dangerous creatures around. So come and join me as we go to Komodo, the home of the Komodo dragon. Now, we've talked about the creature before, but not the island. Komodo, it's in the Lesser Sunda chain of islands in Indonesia. And we're talking about it today, really, because it's just so awesome. It's not necessarily overly deadly, really. The Komodo dragon, though, is the largest lizard on Earth. It's named after the island, and it just lives there. It wanders around between the trees, thrashing its tail, butting and fighting with other Komodos, looking for prey that it can beat and strangle to death before munching it, almost swallowing it whole. Now, what's amazing in this home of the Komodo is that around 2,000 humans live there as well, but maybe not for much longer. There's big talk at the moment that the humans might have to leave and the whole island could be given back to the fearsome dragons. Also, as if the jungle island wasn't amazing enough, it's also one of the only places on the planet where the sand is pink. So perhaps this isn't the most dangerous place that we've spoken about, but it's home to the Komodo dragon. So Komodo, it's just one of the most jaw-dropping places in the entire planet. It's time to keep you fit and healthy now on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, because one of the real dangers to you and your life is a gas. It's a gas that's all over the place. It's a gas that you can't really see. But thankfully, we've got one of our mates, Safety Seymour. He's on hand to tell us more and to save the day.
Safety Seymour, CO Hero.
Safety Seymour at your service. I'm on a mission to recruit CO safety assistants to help on my quest to rid homes of a very dangerous threat. The threat of CO. That's carbon monoxide.
So if I want to become a CO safety assistant, where do I start?
Why not start by thinking about how you stay safe at home?
Cool, but I already feel pretty safe in my home.
That's good. Then let's see how you get on with a few challenges. Sounds like someone's left the bath taps on. How would you prevent a flood in your bathroom?
That's easy. Just make sure the taps are turned off when you've run the bath.
Uh-oh, someone's seen your back door is unlocked and has decided to have a peek inside your house.
Not if we lock the doors when we go out or are all upstairs.
And a burning candle next to a curtain doesn't look very safe.
No trouble. I'll just blow it out. Problem solved.
Fabulous. We keep ourselves safe in our homes in all sorts of ways. But what about dangers that aren't so easy to see?
If you can't see something, doesn't that mean it's not there?
Not always. Think about it. We're surrounded by radio waves and Wi-Fi to play our favourite games and listen to music, but we can't see those waves, can we?
They're not dangerous, though.
That's true, but carbon monoxide is. It's an invisible gas created when boilers, cookers, and heaters aren't burning fuel correctly.
Crikey, that sounds bad.
Very bad. Carbon monoxide steals the oxygen in the air, so there's less around for living things, including you.
Yikes.
It can make you very ill indeed if you breathe it in, or worse.
Then we need to get it out of our homes, or make sure it can escape outside. But if you can't see it, hear it, smell it, taste it, or touch it, how can we find it?
With a very clever gadget, a carbon monoxide alarm.
Cool.
A carbon monoxide alarm is a bit like a smoke alarm, but instead of detecting smoke, it detects...
carbon monoxide?
Bingo! And every house should have one.
So how does it work?
You put it in your home, switch it on, and then if carbon monoxide is detected, it gives you a warning. If you ever hear the alarm, tell an adult and leave the house until it has been checked by a gas-safe registered engineer.
Keep yourself safe and your family out of harm. Get yourself a carbon monoxide alarm.
Right, got to go. In case I'm not around to help, it's a good idea to ask your parents to get a carbon monoxide alarm. Then you too can be a CO safety assistant.
Thanks, Safety Seymour. See you soon.
Safety Seymour, CO Hero, with support from Cadent and Northern Gas Networks. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Seymour.
It is time for this week's Science in the News. Not a brilliant place to start, actually, because some scientists are saying there's just 18 months left to save the world. The Potsdam Climate Institute has said that the next year and a half will be critical in dealing with the global heating crisis and other climate change issues. They've given 2020, the year, as a firm deadline to when things need to start changing by world governments to help the environment. Also, NASA has outlined more details of plans for a landing craft that will take humans to the moon. It's due there by 2024. The mission at the moment is called Artemis 1. They're hopeful that it will stay for 2 weeks on the moon and then will look to turn the moon into a kind of service station on trips further into space. And finally, scientists are thinking of potential for making car parts from weeds. Selena, which is a research group in Poland, they're making eco-friendly plastics from plants using a £13.5 million grant from the EU. It's making car dashboards and other components that are normally made from plastics using plants. And that is it for this week on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. If you've enjoyed any of the series that you've heard so far today, Safety Seymour and Techno Mum, they've got brand new episodes that you can have a listen to over on the free Fun Kids app at funkidslive.com. They're on all the places that you get your podcasts, and they're on Apple as well. And there's so many Fun Kids Science series on Apple that you can check out. And while you're there, it's the best place to leave a review for the Fun Kids Science Weekly and drop your question in the comment box below. I will have a look through what it is, and I will do all the research, all the legwork, and I'll answer your science question on this show, fingers crossed, in the next few weeks. And Fun Kids are a children's radio station from the UK. You can hear us all over the country on your DAB digital radio. We're on that free Fun Kids app, and you can always find us at funkidslive.com. And we've just launched a brand new station, actually. It's called Fun Kids Junior, with songs that little ones can sing and dance around to. So if you love silly tunes like that, maybe you've got a little brother and sister that really love those kind of things, have a listen to Fun Kids Junior. There are loads of games, loads of nursery rhymes, and loads of lullabies to keep you busy all night as well. It's over on Fun Kids Junior, perfect for your little brothers and sisters.